Hey, I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to this episode of the Wisconsin Forward podcast on the Civic Media Radio Network and at civicmedia.us. Today, we're going to be talking about the militarization of policing that Donald Trump has foisted upon several major cities across our country. What is this doing to policing? What is this doing to our democracy? And what can we do about it? We'll try to answer those questions for you. My first guest on this episode is David Cooper, who was the Madison police chief for more than 20 years before becoming a Presbyterian minister for several decades after that. And it was in that latter capacity that David Cooper led the August 2nd Take Up Your Cross protest against Christian nationalism and the cruel and unjust policies of the Trump administration. I was pleased to be part of that demonstration. But David Cooper has never lost his interest in reforming police work. He's the author of a tremendous book called Arrested Development. A veteran police chief sounds off about protest, racism, corruption, and the seven necessary steps to improve our nation's police. And he continues to write about the subject of policing on his amazing blog, which is called, naturally, improvingpolice.blog. David Cooper, welcome back to the Wisconsin Forward podcast.
Happy to be here again and try to air some of these ideas that we think ought to be commonplace.
Yeah, wish that they were. You're one of the leading advocates of police reform that's community-based and that downplays the use of force. So what Trump is doing by militarizing the police and bringing in the National Guard must be a nightmare for you.
I think that's the correct word. I think it's a nightmare. I think it's an alternate reality. It's something I never, ever thought would happen in all my years. I really thought for, you know, that we have high aspirations in this nation, and I think that's a part of who we are. Do we always achieve them? No, but we aspire. And I thought, well, we're going to keep on aspiring. We're going to try to do a little bit better every year. And then all of a sudden we're not, we're sliding backwards. I mean, where are the originalists on our Supreme Court right now? Because of the originalists would have turned over in their grave about these autocratic efforts and support from our legal institutions about a president that's gone awry. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
He's gone awry.
Oh, totally awry. And he's like, you know, the King of England bringing his troops into people's homes before the Revolutionary War.
That's right. Well, you know, our founder said, no kings, no bishops. And at least we were half right.
It must be difficult for you. You're 87. I'm 67. To see everything you've worked for kind of going down the tubes. I know it's rough for me.
Yeah, it's, what do we, you know, what do we say to our grandkids? One of the things I think I posted when we were talking about getting people behind this cross march, a lot of Christians said, oh, I can't go out there and do something like that. So why is that? Oh, well, the cross, I mean, that's, well, you're a Christian. What else have you got? You know, the cross has sort of been our traditional symbol of death, but also of resurrection and hope for the future. So I think that the one thing that came out of that, people coming down on a Saturday morning, the takeaway was people said afterwards, they said, you know, I protested against the war and about I protested against Jim Crow laws. I've done all this stuff, but I've never ever in my whole life stood up for my faith. And so that was a new experience by a lot of people. And I think if we did gain one thing, it was that people can come out with their core values and the group that I was privileged to be a part of. This idea that we would have a big banner that would say "Resist government cruelty." So that's my argument, and some members of my family that say, well, what's wrong with all this? And I said, okay, if we want to fix things, that's good. Let's fix them. But we don't have to be cruel when we fix things.
And there's a level of cruelty, even sadism, on the part of Trump and some of his ideologues behind him, and then in some of these gestures that we've seen from ICE and National Guardsmen. You say the putting the National Guard in our big cities, L.A., D.C., Chicago, who knows what's next, Memphis. You say this is not just misguided, it's illegal, unnecessary, and deeply, deeply un-American. Why?
I think absolutely. I mean, I mean, our founders, you know, were very, very wary of central control coming from a monarchy. I think they were very, very concerned, and certainly the first 10 amendments to our Constitution talks about those really concerns about speech and assembly and about the sanctity of your home. And those very, very important things, you know, specifically that we're not going to be able to house soldiers can't come into our home like the British did and take over and say that's our residence because the king said so. So I think that we have this very strong tradition of being wary of autocracy. And, you know, how we can stand by without some, you know, major disruptions and watch officials, agents of our government, with the job of enforcing our immigration laws, to go in camouflaged uniforms, no name tags, and masks in an American city is outrageous, of the highest order. And in some cases where let's say local police would be looking for criminals, unless the criminal was known to be armed and dangerous, would not be displaying, you know, long guns and pointing them at citizens. For right now, all of a sudden, you know, this is what we went through in Madison, 1973. Student protests about the war, about civil rights, that it came to be that there was an attitude on the police department that these people were criminals because they were breaking our traffic laws by being in the street.
Yeah, the students were their enemies. The students were the enemy.
We were fighting them, and you know, so how do we turn that around? And I remember, early only months into my my appointment here, there was going to be a large demonstration, and the newly elected sheriff Bill Ferris was there. I forget who was the chancellor at the university. He was there. County officials, city officials were there, and we're going to say, well, this is how we're going to respond. We're going to work with people. We're going to allow people to go into the streets. We're not going to fight over keeping people on the sidewalk, because there's a greater value here, and that is the right of people who protest what's going on in their government peaceably. And if they're peaceable, we would let them come into the, and we would regulate the traffic. And I remember dear number two in command, in front of everyone, saying, "Chief, we have fought long and hard to keep the students out of the street. I just hope you're not going to let them go into the street." And I said, "Well, Inspector, yes, we are, because we're going to have a peaceful protest here, and we're going to help people use their civil rights to protest what they think the government's doing wrong. That's who we are."
But Trump doesn't believe in the First Amendment or protest, and he calls, some of the protesters. I mean, he talks about the enemy from within.
Well, protest means you're not on my side. That should be illegal.
That's what he thinks. Anyone who's not for him is anarchist, leftist, Antifa, un-American, and should be, brought to heel. And so when he brings in soldiers, you wrote in one of your blog posts, soldiers are trained for combat, not policing. So,
that's right.
What's going to happen when the soldiers are there?
Yeah, I spent 4 years in active duty of the Marines, 6 years in the reserve. I tell you, we were not trained to handle protest. The whole nature. I mean, we train our military to kill the enemy. We don't train them to negotiate and have a middle ground that we could both live peaceably together. We don't do that, and it's unfair. It is really unfair to the men and women in our military to say that they're going to go into the cities and do police work. What kind of police work? What? How are they trained? Are they trained in methods of investigation? Are they trained in methods of being able to reduce conflict? And no, they're not. And it's not fair to put them in there. So the worst thing a leader can do is put an employee into a situation where he or she doesn't know what their job is.
Especially when they have lethal force.
Yes. Weapons.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen Miller was even talking about having Trump bring the 82nd Airborne into these cities.
Hello. Is this America?
It isn't America right
we
now.
We hear somebody knocking on the door. Is this us? This doesn't sound like us.
And then there is the example in Chicago where ICE was rappelling down from helicopters into an apartment building in the middle of the night, barging down people's doors, arresting them, dragging them out naked.
Oh, my gosh. If I was Pete Hegseth, I would just be so happy.
Yeah, but if you're the mayor of Chicago, you're not happy if you're those people in there. And I remember listening to Tom Hartman.
You know, and the great myth is 1,100 undocumented people in a broken immigration system. We all agree with that. Okay, we all agree. It's broken. Should we be more cautious, more careful? Yeah, we should be. We need to improve that system. We need some help. And if there are, in fact, murderers, rapists, and drug dealers out there, I think we would, the undocumented immigrant community would say, yes, get them out. They're hurting us too. Please let us go about our work paying taxes and going through a process because we want to be one of you because we believe in what you have. That's why we came here under great stress. We came to your country to be one of you, to help you make this country great. So get them out of there. So people still believe that what we're doing is rounding up murderers, rapists, and drug dealers, and we're not.
That's not what they're doing in Chicago.
No, it's false. It's false. The data do not show that.
Right, and I remember one of the ICE guys was saying to a bystander, he was saying, what about the kids? And he said, F the kids, when they, you know, arrested these kids. I mean, it's amazing. So Tom Hartman was saying, you know, they're breaking every law in the books, including the Fourth Amendment right to be secure in your homes and all that.
Absolutely. So that's interesting about the children. Remember when they decided people coming across the border, we'd separate their children? You know, and it's like, you know, I spent 33 years of my life in police. I know the dark side. And I can imagine this kind of conversation going on in Washington. Well, we've got those people coming over with their children. I can't believe they would do that. Yeah, well, if we took away their kids, they wouldn't be so quick to come across the border. Oh, hey, that's a great idea. We'll tell them we're going to separate their kids. And they won't be coming here. So we do that. We say, okay, we have taken this whole group of people. We've separated them from the kids. Okay, we'll show them. And then somebody says, do we know which people we took away their kids from? Can we identify them? Oh my gosh, I hadn't thought of that. You know, those conversations I think occurred. And the other side of that thing, and throughout the years when maybe we would have police staff meetings and maybe one of my lieutenants would come up, hey, I got a great idea. Let's separate their children. I'd say, yeah, okay. I'm sure that would be a negative effect. I would think twice about going across the border where they took my children away. But is this the right thing to do?
Yeah, well, I don't think that question's being asked in Washington, in the Trump administration anyway. Now, you've written that local police need to resist, cooperate.
Yeah, people are angry at me over that, but I maintain it. I maintain that who will protect us? Who will protect us in our communities if our local police, who have sworn an oath of office to protect us and to protect the Constitution of our country, does not somehow step up when people are being either illegally or immorally arrested and detained? What are we going to do? Because one good thing, at least in the Third Reich in Germany, if you had papers, you could show your papers. You would come up here, come show me your papers. You know, all the World War II movies. Show me your papers. Okay, so at least we had papers to say, look, I'm a citizen here, and look, I'm not Jewish. I've got a certification here that I'm not Jewish, so I don't get to go. Oh, okay, all right, you can go now. We don't have papers. So if anybody came up to you or me, I mean, how would you prove your citizenship? Rothschild, that sounds, well, maybe, where'd you come from?
Right.
Cooper, are you one of them Scots people that were resisting the British?
So, but to play it out, so if the local police see ICE or a National Guardsman doing something, barging into a door without a warrant, which is a violation of the Fourth Amendment, what is that local police officer supposed to do?
So this is what I'm recommending. And this is somewhat consistent with what, at least I understand, the rules of policy in Los Angeles are between the mayor and the chief of police, is that police officers need to show up at instances where the ICE is in operation. They need to video record what's going on. They need to identify the ICE officers who are unidentifiable and masked as to who they are, and to have the name and information of the person they are detaining, and to ascertain whether it is an administrative warrant or a legal warrant signed by a judge. At a minimum, that must go on. So I'm wondering, okay, let's say I'm a police officer on the street and I've been called, and there's ICE officers and they have this person, and the person is saying, I'm a citizen, what are you doing? I'd say, well, just what's going on here? Well, I am a citizen, and this person is illegally arresting me, detaining me. What, you know, stop them, help me here.
Yeah, they're kidnapping me, person might say.
That's right, they're kidnapping me, and they're masked. They're unidentifiable people who can use and have used force against people like me who resist. What would a local police officer do? I would think that somehow there's got to be a freeze frame. Stop. We're going to sort this out. Hold this right here. We're going to determine whether this person is, and no, you're not going to take her or him to a nice facility where in the course of a few days they'll determine whether or not you're a citizen. We'll determine right now whether or not this person is a citizen, and if he or she is, keep your hands off of them.
Now, are you suggesting that police officer should bring his weapon out and say stop?
Well, I would hope he or she could do this without bringing out their weapon, but could it, let's physically intervene if necessary. Stop. We're gonna hold this thing right here. We're gonna find out what the information is. So I think that, you know, it kind of, even more that, you know, what is your status in the immigration court? I mean, these are administrative law. They're not crimes. They're not crimes. And what we, as a police officer, would be seeing is someone who is being, in effect, kidnapped.
And kidnapping is a crime.
And we should stop people being kidnapped and detained and put into a place where that's called a jail. That should be illegally. But somehow, you know, the fear. And that's why they're masked. They're not masked because they're worried about people might find out who they are, because every enforcement officer in the whole country could say that.
Right.
I'm not going to wear my name tag. I'm not going to give my name to you because you might come back at me. Well, if you're behaving yourself, no one's going to come back on you. And the second thing is the whole business of masking is to incite fear in us.
You know, I'm worried that either ICE officers or the National Guard or, you know, the 82nd or Airborne or some unit is going to open fire on protesters.
Well,
it's going to be like Kent State.
Yeah. Kent State. It's going to happen. You know, if you got guns out and you're feeling threatened and you're fearful, people have been killed in our country.
And what would happen if that were to occur, if there's another Kent State?
Well, in a presidentially controlled legal system, is that, well, they shouldn't have been resisting. That was criminal behavior to protest what I'm doing.
And that'll really tear this country apart.
Well, I think so. Kent State almost did. It was amazing how we got through Kent State. Really, when you think about it, my gosh, you know, in Ohio, the National Guard was deployed untrained. All of a sudden, somebody started shooting, and more dead in Ohio. Four dead in Ohio. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young.
And how did we get through that period then?
Well, I think we had leadership in this country that that said that what Dr. King and others were trying to do. Look at all the heat Dr. King got when he came out against the Vietnam War. Oh wait, that's too much. You shouldn't do that. I think we had enough. Well, protest meant something. It doesn't mean anything today. That's the trouble. When you've got Truth Social and millions of people looking at presidential edicts, not by fiat, but by social media, we've got a problem.
And then are you worried about the Insurrection Act and that Trump is just going to say, enough is enough. I'm invoking the Insurrection Act. Yeah. We got martial law here.
We know that's coming. I mean, it's got to. The rhetoric was there. This country is out of control. Portland's out of control, and we'll show video from 2020 when things were out of control. Chicago's out of control. Washington's out of control. Well,
even though crime rate's down 30% or whatever.
Don't bother me with that. But see, people believe, the big lie. The big lie. And never deny, just continue to lie. And that's what seems to be working right now. But then it really hasn't affected anybody other than people who have accents and whose skin is brown in our country. And by the time it affects you and I, it's going to be too late.
Yeah, and that time is coming.
It's Pastor Niemöller.
Right.
Back in the 30s and after everything happened in Germany, saying, when they came after the communists, well, I was not a communist. And they came after gypsies. I was not a gypsy. And they came after the homosexual. Well, I was not. And then he said, the end statement is that when they came after me, there was no one to protest. Well, I think now is the time for us to protest. And we need leadership here to help us get this country back on track again.
Yeah, we need faith voices like yours. We need leadership within police departments. We need leadership within the military. We saw all those generals sitting stone-faced at that most ridiculous speech by Hegseth and then by Trump.
That was a hopeful day. That was a hopeful day that at least, but, it doesn't come through. It doesn't come through the big orders. It doesn't come from the president telling the general, go out and stop that stuff out there, or you need to make it difficult, or you need to arrest these people. It starts incrementally, bit by bit, to when they say, okay, when they come out again, shoot them because they're criminals, they're protesting. Could this happen in America? Asked me this 10 years ago. I said, absolutely not. We are developing, we are growing, we're becoming a good nation. We help other people in the world. We have a good heart. It's not going to happen here. But I can't say that anymore.
So how are we going to get through this period?
I'm waiting. I know that what I write has little impact. I know that our conversations here over the last few weeks have little impact, but it has some impact. I guess it has some impact. What I'm hoping is that somebody comes forth to take up the torch, and it's going to be difficult because all the power is on the other side now, and all the fear is within the country. Something, it's got to. I've yet to be affected. You probably haven't been affected. Most of us haven't been affected yet. We think we know what's going to happen, and it's not going to be good. But it really hasn't happened yet about our health care, or about our economy, or about our legal system, but it is. And to watch Pam Bondi jousting with our nation's leaders, it's scary.
Yeah, it's a scary time. We're going to need more voices.
I mean, I might not have been the best advocate for Jim Comey, and I criticized some of the things he did, and the FBI probably needs some improvement, but not this way. We don't get what we want by prosecuting our enemies in the long run.
But do you think we will get through this?
Well, as a person of faith, I have hope. And I know that I only have a short time on this planet, and I know that there's a divine essence in the universe that will eventually put this right.
Oh, I hope so. David Cooper, thanks so much for being my guest again on the Wisconsin Ford Podcast. It's always great talking with you. With me now is my friend and occasional guest co-host on the Civic Media Radio Network, Angela Lang. You'll often get to hear Angela on the Maggie Dawn Show and on Matt Nair on Air, and she's also a prize-winning columnist for the Recombobulation Area, and all that's on her spare time, because by day, she's the executive director of BLOC, Black Leaders Organizing for Communities. Angela, welcome to the Wisconsin Forward Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, for people who are listening who don't know about BLOC, why don't you take a second or two to explain what your organization's all about?
Yeah, so we're a year-round civic engagement organization that started in 2017. So our anniversary is coming up actually next month in November.
Congratulations.
Thank you. One of the things that we wanted to do was to kind of reshift and reframe how electoral politics is done in the Black community. After the 2016 election, there was a lot of hot takes, some of which included that it was the Black community's fault. And we had talked to folks, we had heard stories that people didn't feel that they were engaged or were some of the most disenfranchised. And so how do we kind of take some of those issues and challenges and have a year-round strategy and try to build that long-term Black political power? So our team, even though we don't have elections right now, their team is knocking on doors. We have monthly community meetings, which we just had one on Saturday. We're gearing up for our Halloween event for the kids. We have all sorts of different give back type of events for the community, but we're also making sure that people understand what's going on and helping people make sense of this moment. And they know how to use their voices and advocate for that as well.
What are people hearing at the doors, by the way?
You know, I think right now people are just thinking that things feel really crazy. And I think it's hard to kind of stay grounded with everything that's happening. People are working multiple jobs, you know, kids are back in school, you're wrestling with childcare. You know, we're hearing a lot around childcare, even amongst our own team, with some of the challenges that they have. And I think right now people are scared. People are like, what is going on federally? You know, are we going to have civil rights anymore? And so I think that there is a lot of fear, but I also think people are hurting with the economy, right? People expected, or people were told, I should say, during the campaign that inflation and all these things were going to be affordable suddenly on day one, and we're not seeing that. And so we see small businesses that are hurting. And we've seen, you know, more and more community members have to come by and utilize our services for like our back to school drive and our toy drive. We're anticipating having more requests for toys at the end of the year, just because people are navigating such, I would say, tumultuous times, not only financially, but I also think like mentally. Every time you turn on the news, there's another attack or there's something else on potentially your community.
Yeah, I mean, Trump hasn't been very subtle about that now, has he?
No, not at all. He's been making it very clear.
No, Angela Lang, you had a recent piece at the Recombobulation Area called Weaponizing the National Guard is Fascism. I'd like to talk with you about that. I mean, this downhill spiral toward fascism is happening so fast, and we're seeing it most noticeably with this use of the National Guard. How is this hitting you? You and your organization have talked 180 degrees from this kind of militarized approach to policing, and yet here it is upon us.
Yeah, you know, I would say that there is a lot of organizations like BLOC that had been concerned about the militarization of police long before Trump. Right. You start to pay attention to police budgets and they become more and more bloated. And then you start to look in the details and some of the equipment and the little toys and tools that they want to have, such as facial recognition technology, which we're trying to stop in the city of Milwaukee. All of that had been a concern for a while. Right. We had seen how we are investing more into policing than in some cases education. Right. And so this had been something that I think a lot of folks had been worried about when you started to see the militarization of policing. And like I said, this is long before Trump. It's been long before this moment. But when you have a president who is, like you said, Matt, not being shy about anything that he is saying or any of his threats, we see that it is a little bit more of a concern. Being able to weaponize things like the National Guard and using the military on its own citizens, I think, is a different level. And so for us, you know, the first priority always is to, you know, keep us safe, the organization safe, but specifically the team that is out knocking doors and doing the work. And for us, we never thought that safety equaled more police. We've had police interactions at our office and police harassment at our office. We've seen our team being, you know, pulled up and harassed when they're knocking doors by police. And if this is what the case was long before Trump was elected, we can only imagine now in this political climate how tense and how scary things are even more now.
Yeah, you wrote in this article that this isn't about public safety. If we're serious about public safety, you wrote, we wouldn't be cutting services and access to healthcare, housing, resources for lower income residents, education, and so much more. And that's been your long-term critique of misguided budgets in Milwaukee and across the country, for that matter. Leaving aside the Trump militarization for a second, what are some of the successes of this kind of approach to crime that and a kind of community-based, social-based response to crime and policing?
Yeah, I mean, we see, you know, community-based solutions where there's kind of policing through a community lens, and it's through a level of accountability and restorative justice. We've also seen mayors, specifically Black mayors across the country in places like Baltimore, that are investing into programs such as after-school programs and youth programs. A lot of times, people think of crime and they think of it at a very surface level. But if you want to get to the root cause of crime, you have to invest in these things, because that's a lot of the reason why people are doing these crimes, is because they're trying to survive. I often said, I don't believe that people just wake up and are like, I'm going to play Scarface today because I saw it in a movie and that looks cool, right? You know, people aren't just glamorizing crime. I think a lot of times people are struggling and are trying to survive. And so if we want to actually reduce crime, we should make sure that people are whole and make sure that people's basic needs are met. And so when you see a rise in policing without that investment in the community, you're not actually going to get the results of a decrease in crime, because only investing in policing is putting a Band-Aid on it. Police don't actually reduce crime. They respond to it after something happens. So how do we make sure that they don't even have to respond in the first place because the crime isn't happening?
Angela, in Milwaukee, where you live, how's the mayor there, Johnson, been handling the issue of crime?
You know, I will say that this is one of the points of, you know, disagreement that Block often has with the mayor. We don't think that there should be more investment into policing, but we also know that the shared revenue deal, you know, Act 12 had allowed for having to maintain levels of the police. And so we did, you know, critique the mayor when that the Act 12 was happening, because they had some poison pills. We wanted to raise our taxes, otherwise we would go bankrupt. But Republicans said they would only allow it if we kept policing at same levels or higher. So no longer being able to divest or defund the police. It gutted our fire and police commission authority and put a lot of it back in the hands of the police chief, so our oversight mechanism. And then it put cops back in schools. And mind you, those three kind of poison pills had nothing to do with, you know, being able to raise a sales tax in Milwaukee. And it was something that the mayor had to fight for, I would say, you know, giving him a little bit of grace. He was in a terrible position as a mayor with his financial constraints. I just wish we could have reached a deal where those things didn't happen. But we're watching right now very closely in how the mayor and how he's proposing his budget, but then also he is in current contract negotiations with the Milwaukee Police Association because he's not giving them their nearly 13% raise that they're asking for. And so we do appreciate the mayor saying, you know, I'm not going to give the police a 13% raise. And we want to make sure that he holds on to that. You know, contract negotiations are tricky. Last I heard, they were in arbitration, and we'll see what happens from that. So we're watching closely. You know, it is budget season, so people are talking about what the budget means for them and what it looks like. We're combing through it ourselves. But it's the mayor, you know, we know that the mayor has to is in a different spot than, say, someone like myself, right? I get a chance to kind of say and be a little bit more outspoken on what should be invested in and what shouldn't be. But I do wish the mayor would be a little bit more bold and reimaginative, so we wouldn't have to constantly be bloating this police budget.
And you mentioned the Milwaukee Police Association. What's up with that group? Because in September, the head of the group basically was inviting Trump to send troops to Milwaukee.
Yeah, that was really kind of like the impetus for the article. Quite frankly, you know, we knew that they were having a protest of the mayor because of the contract negotiations. And we had been keeping an eye on that. We were curious of how it was going to go. And that was on a Friday. On Wednesday before is when the police association president said that, you know, if the mayor isn't going to support his own cops, maybe I should ask Donald Trump to bring in the National Guard to Milwaukee. So that sounded a bunch of alarm bells for us organizers, and we put together a counter protest very quickly. It's interesting because you know, the president, he wanted to kind of appear kind of like this tough guy, and you know, but I think at every moment he was making some missteps, and that's just not my bias, but that's just general missteps. I think, you know, him saying that and threatening to bring in the National Guard, I don't think some of his own rank and file union members would have agreed with that. I also think that they thought it put their raise in jeopardy by saying that. So I think I don't know what fully is up with that guy, but the instant that, you know, we did our counter protest, they saw us and then they went inside. So he's not exactly operating from a position of strength, in my opinion.
And has since retracted, I hear, his invitation to Trump to bring the National Guard in.
Yeah, I mean, we're still watching. He could, you know, that comment came out of nowhere. Clearly, I think just off of the cuff and without running it by his own membership. But, you know, he shouldn't have said it in the first place. So while he may have retracted, we're still going to keep an eye on some of those comments, because if he can just say that off the cuff and use that as a real tangible threat, it goes to show that we should really be paying attention to his words and actions.
And what would happen if Trump, whether the police association had asked for it or not, Trump says, I'm going to, you know, Milwaukee's next, National Guard's come to Milwaukee. How do you think Milwaukee would respond?
I think that's something that a lot of organizers are planning and thinking about, and not planning because we want it to happen, but just being prepared in case it does. There's a lot of organizers that are connected to organizers in Chicago, supporting them, also doing solidarity marches and rallies, saying, you know, we stand in solidarity with Chicago and we're not going to allow this here. I can imagine a lot of those same organizers that are part of those solidarity marches are going to respond. And, you know, for me, I've had the scenario in my head of what does it look like if suddenly he says, yeah, Milwaukee is next, and he does bring in the National Guard. I do think that there will be a strong response. The mayor said that he does not think that the National Guard is needed. And I can only hope that the governor would agree with that as well. And so I would hope that our elected officials, especially our mayor and our governor, are standing strong and outspoken if that were to ever happen. But I could see it could actually be some protests and some resistance. And I think the big priority is making sure that everyone is kept safe. But I think that's the point, is that he's trying to, you know, minimize a level of resistance because of fear. You know, people saying, I met someone recently and she said, you know, I'm not really going to protest, but I'm going to the one on the 18th. And I'll be lying if I didn't say I was a little scared, but I don't care. Whatever they got going on, I don't care. And I think that's really powerful, because if people are so scared to actually exercise the rights that we currently have, then they will be taken away.
Yeah, and then we really don't even have them in actual exactly. practice anyway. They're gone.
Exactly.
Have you given thought, I'm sure you have, I have too, to what happens if it goes from bringing in the National Guard to invoking the Insurrection Act? And then what do you do?
Yeah, I think that's where things really get incredibly scary. I think I've always thought about this in like a two-prong approach. There's kind of the mutual aid, the kind of underground, how do we keep people safe aspect? And there's going to be people that and networks that step in and fill that gap in making sure that folks that are the most vulnerable, whether it be immigrants, Black folks, trans folks, et cetera, are safe.
You know, Angela, every time we talk together, we bat around the idea of how are we going to get through this period?
Yeah.
Do you have are you able to see around the corner on this?
Not at the moment. I did see a meme the other day on social media that was like, yeah, there is no light at the end of the tunnel. It's kind of dark right now. I don't understand. So that's kind of how I'm feeling, because I don't know what the answers are. No one does. We don't know how or when we really get out of this. And I think that determines how bad things will get. I think a big indicator is we'll see what the midterms look like and what those elections and the process specifically of those elections look like. But I think in the meantime, while we're in this dark period, I just keep having to remind myself, what does it look like to be in community with people? Right. We've had some kids in the office and me tapping in with childcare with a baby on my hip, and we're playing with slime right at the office. So for me, I think it's being able to have those people, to have your village, to have your people when things are hard. Right. Things may be metaphorically burning outside, but who are your people that you can still feel alive with? And that's what I hope other people can do, too.
Oh, I think that's a great note to end on. Be in community, support your people, love your people. Angela Lang, thanks so much. You're a tremendous asset to the whole state of Wisconsin, the whole country for that matter. Thanks for being my guest.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's going to have to be it for this episode of the Wisconsin Forward podcast on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm Matt Rothschild, and I want to thank our two great guests, David Cooper and Angela Lang. I also want to thank my engineer and producer, Dom Lee, who's always great to work with. And I want to thank Sage Weil of Civic Media for giving me this platform. But most of all, I want to thank you for listening. I'll be back soon with another episode of the Wisconsin Forward podcast, where I'll dive deeper into the discussion about how to resist authoritarianism. I'm looking forward to that one, and I hope you are too, because the fight must go on.